all right, we're going. What we're trying to do is we're trying to study ephemeral astrology. And we're doing this to get the feel and the familiarity of the times. And we're doing that by looking at what my experience finds to be the most obvious components of what the times feel like. We want to know what the times are like so that we can look at history, or we can look what produces an event, or what produces a question. And we began last time with the study of cycles. And we looked at unary cycles. And we looked last time at longitudinal unary cycles, which are at the very basis or the very foundation of all astrology and of the zodiac itself. In fact, last time we looked at a little bit of elementary zodiology and how the zodiac came to be and how it relates to astronomy in a peculiar way. This time we're going to look at another kind of unary cycle. We're going to look at a whole family of them again, but we're going to primarily look at the cycle, unary cycle of the sun, because that's the one that we are most familiar with and that seems to be most dominant in our environment. Now, the unary cycle of the sun is sometimes called the cycle of Persephone, because in the story of Demeter and Persephone, that myth is a story that lives out the cycle. And it could be associated with the Christ cycle, which piggybacks on the cycle of Persephone, but that's something that's way beyond these talks. Now, this is a subject that I have been studying between 55 and 60 years. I grew up on a farm, and it was a small 40-acre farm, and it was basically almost square, or perfectly rectangular. This was a highway along here, and this was a country road along here that continued on, and the back fields were shorter than the front fields. Woods in which there were Indian mounds and everything. And the house we lived in was, big mistake, never touched the blackboard. The house was here, and the summer kitchen was here, and the woodshed was here, and the outhouse was here, and the barn was here, and machinery shed was here, silo was here, and this was garden, this was a circular drive, and this was all garden. Back here was a very large elm tree in which there used to sit a hawk. And I can remember as a child looking out the west window of the house. This was west, this was north. And as I was, I'm blocking you all out, aren't I? And as I would sit here after supper time in the house and look, I would see where the sun would set. This should be moved back. The tree is actually back here. No, I never got, never had a woodshed session as a child. And from the house, I would watch. This was all woods over here. This was all woods over here that was filled with raspberries. This was filled with squirrels. This was old woods, and this was Second World War. But I would watch from the house where the sun would set, between the tree and the woods. And as a little child, it was a mystery. I knew it had something to do with the time of the year where the sun set relative to the tree. And I kept pondering that, and so it's been between 55 and 60 years now that that has been in my consciousness. And in that 60 years, this is what has come out of it. Now, the phenomenon of the declination of the sun can be described in several different ways. If we have the Earth, there are two measurement systems. There is that which is based on the celestial equator. If you go north or south, that's called astronomical or celestial declination. If you're taking the ecliptic, which is on an angle, then if you go at right angles to that, that is called astronomical latitude. So declination is strictly local to the Earth. And it's the declinational cycle that we're going to be looking at, and we're going to look at it in several ways. The sun, as it appears from the Earth, goes north into the far up until the Tropic of Cancer, where it is there at the summer solstice, and then it comes down to the equator at the fall equinox, and then it goes down to the Tropic of Capricorn, and then it comes back up at the vernal equinox. That is the path that it forms, and it goes up and down. This is a drawing of that path, as is this. And we'll get to a more elaborate explanation of this as we go on. But so the sun is continuously changing declination. This is as if a stopped action, where if you took the, this is all the Earth, but it's broken up into two hemispheres, the summer hemisphere and a winter hemisphere. But if you were out in space exactly over the equator and you took the noon spot for the, took a 24-hour spot every day and mapped it, it would look like this. It's not a perfect sine wave, nor is this a perfect sine wave. But that is what it looks like. If you are at any place on the surface of the Earth and at the same time in a 24-hour cycle, take a photograph of the sun, like say every day at 8 in the morning, you get a figure that is called an analemma. It's something like a figure 8, except that the sun stays in the northern hemisphere longer than it does in the southern hemisphere, and it looks something like that. If you have a globe, you'll often see an analemma on the side of the globe. They're just different ways of describing the same phenomenon. Now, if you look from a polar point of view, this is the sun, and the Earth is rotating on its axis, and it's revolving around the sun. When at the summer solstice, it points right exactly at the Tropic of Cancer. At the winter solstice, it points at the Tropic of Capricorn. This is not very well drawn, but this is supposed to come to exactly the equinox as the Earth in its inclination is going around the band of stars. The sun is a great big ball of light, and all of the planets are in one disk around it. And that disk, as seen from the Earth, is called the as the sun goes, as the Earth goes around the sun, it's on its angle. That's what we have in the polar view. I think the width of the disk that the planet's in is something like 11 degrees, with the exception of Pluto, which is quite erratic, and it gets outside of that. Of all of the fundamental planets, Mercury is inclined to this is going on. And this then is a graphing of that. The Tropic of Capricorn or Cancer is at 23 degrees, 21 minutes, 23 seconds. But that is something that's varying because the Earth is not constant. And as a consequence, that defines the width of the tropics, and it defines the zones where there are either perpetual illumination or where there is perpetual darkness, depending on the season of the year. Ooh, no, I have not. Thank you very much. I have completely forgotten that. I'll have to take one off of the DVD or something like that. Too many machines to be thinking about. Now, this curve has a name, beside being the graph of the solar declination. It is called the Python, serpent Python, which goes back to Greek mythology. It goes back to the great oracle at Delphi. The oracle at Delphi has always been a place where there has been prophecy. And first, the oracle was controlled by the earth spirit. And people worshiped the earth spirit. Was feminine. And they would go there for prophecies. After a while, that religion died out. And the cave, actually the place was a temple built around a cave where there was a cleft in the ground. And the Pythonesses, who were mediums, would sit in a chair on a tripod over this crevice in the ground. And when gases came out of the ground, they would prophesy. People would ask them questions, and they would take prophecy. But the cave was taken over by this gigantic serpent until Apollo took the challenge of overcoming the serpent Python. And he went to Delphi, and he struggled with the serpent, and he struggled for an entire year. And after he struggled with the serpent, he overcame it, and he took it to himself, the oracle. And after that, he was known as Apollo, who sees all and knows all. In fact, one of the names for Apollo is Apollo Pythias, which is kind of curious because another name for Apollo is Apollo Smithias, which is where our name Smith comes from. But that was Apollo that was the mouse god, and it is the pythons that eat the mice. But that's something all completely extraneous. So we're going to be looking at that serpent python. By the way, the oracle went on until the time of Christ. And at the time of Christ, all of the oracles went dead. Supposedly, the oracle at Delphi, there was the major earthquake that is associated with the crucifixion, and that earthquake changed the nature of the cleft in the earth, and the gases that came out no longer had that same effect on sensitive people. Now, in mathematics, the curve has the same name. It is called the sinusoidal wave, or the sinusoidal curve, which means snake-like. And in mathematics, there is a branch called synthesis, which is actually a compound between analysis harmonic analysis and harmonic synthesis. Mathematics can be broken into three different major branches. One is associated with the first attribute of Trinity, the permanency attitude, and that is associated with the Father or with Saturn or Pluto. The analysis, which is the study of waves and curves, is ruled by the Sun, S-O-N, and by the Sun, S-U-N. And things that deal with frequency or number theory or things like that, arithmetic, all of those are ruled by the third attribute of the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, or the Shiv principle, if you're interested in India, and that is ruled by the moon. And the interesting thing is about mathematics, in any one of these three branches, like, for example, anything geometric can be turned into a wave, can be translated, the meaning, through trigonometry or through analytic geometry. Geometric things can be turned into things of analysis, of curves. So they're in the same way that they talk about unity and trinity and trinity and unity, so that it's all one spirit, but that the three attributes are interchangeable according to what needs to be done. That is exactly what happens in mathematics. Now, we are using three-dimensional Cartesian coordinates, which means that we have a horizontal axis, which is almost always time, and we have a vertical axis, which is an axis of amplitude, is what it's called in physics or in mathematics. We could state all of the same things that we're talking about in terms of a polar axis, and then what we're talking about would be some form of a figure eight or lemniscate, but that isn't too easy to work with. So we'll use the standard definition. The beginning of the curve, where the horizontal meets the vertical, is usually called the primary node. It's sometimes called the origin. And everything that goes to the right from that primary node is called the forward progress of time. When you reach the top, you reach a tangent point. The solstices are tangent points, and they represent a bounds or a limit. It can go no further than this. And all right, I don't know what more to say about that. The whole period from when a cycle begins until it repeats itself is called the period. It's associated with frequency when you put it on the axis of time. How far up or how far down or how far positive or how far negative, that is called the amplitude of it. We associate amplitude with volume and how loud, how intense it is. Now, almost what we have with the solar declinational curve is an idealized or a standardized curve. But any curve can be broken down and rebroken down, which is what harmonic analysis is all about. The whole idea is to bring something to a point, and that represents the smallest derivative as part of that curve. It represents a moment, or it represents an event, or it represents an epitomization. If you want to know the tend or trend of any given point, suppose we have a point somewhere like this, suppose this is the camera can't see this, but if you want to find the trend of one particular point, you produce a tangent to it, and you take the derivative of that, and that is a line. So we have a point and a line, and then when you do successive derivatives of lines, you end up with an arc. Ultimately, the whole idea is to see things in terms of a circle as a total. You could carry it into other dimensions and get other figures out of it, but that's going too far. What we're going to do for all of this introductory explanation is a pretty light and a pretty uncomplicated study of what has been called serpent wisdom. And we'll have very, very little mathematics to guide us. You can get into very deep and very precise mathematics in this, but it's just too much. All right, let's look at the Earth itself. The Earth has two types of extremes. They are the two polar regions, which are called frigid zones. And they have the area that the serpent passes right over, which is called either the tropics or the torrid zone. So there are polar extremes and there are equatorial extremes. Now at the equator, because the Earth is rotating on its axis, it's, in terms of extensive measurement, things are moving along quite swiftly. The angular velocity is the same. It's 24 hours in order to make one rotation. But 24 hours at the equator means much more space that you're traveling through. Whereas if you're standing right at the pole, there's hardly any movement in space at all. So the equatorial regions then, that extreme, is associated with exoteric or material change. And because there is plenty of time and little change in space, and time is the potential of spirit, then at the polar extremes, it is a matter of things being extremely spiritual. Now, one would expect that at the poles, that there would be more inward awareness and more of a need for will to fight off the cold. That's exactly what we find, a strong assertion of will, whereas the passivity that we find in the equatorial regions, you know, that's where most of the mediumship in the world is was a commonplace kind of thing. That's what we find. So there are two different kinds of consciousness for the frigid and the tropical zones. They're not, because human beings aren't greatly different from each other, they are general tendencies and that prevail, but things tend more toward the material and more toward relaxation in the tropics, and there is more rigidity and more forcefulness of will in the frigid zones. In fact, this is something that psychologists have done. They have put people in rooms, telling them that they're waiting for something or another, and they give them a pad of paper, and they change the conditions of the climatic conditions of the room, the atmospheric conditions, so that it is more like a hot, steamy tropic, or it is more like the cold, frigid zones, and they find out that what happens is that the more it is like the tropics, the more the doodles that people make are curvilinear. They're round and they're more imaginative in that way. Whereas when things get more like the frigid zones, they're more straight-lined and they're more acute and they take on that kind of quality. There are lots of things, for example, in terms of botanical evolution. Forms, it appears, originate at the equator, and if there are changes in forms there. It start at the equator and then they work their way towards the poles. Whereas new ideas and intellectual philosophies are very frequently originated at the poles and work their way toward the equator. For example, if we look at what is presaging a time when all of humanity will be considered each equal with the other, all of the attempts for that are found at the extreme latitudes. Russia and Sweden and Canada are by far much more socialistic than we find in countries near the equator. Now, when we look at a curve, we find something similar. The equinoctial nodal positions are the times when the light changes more per day than at any other time. Like the shortening of the days, you don't notice it in August, even though they're getting shorter, but suddenly it gets to be mid-September and the days shorten very rapidly. At the solstices, either winter or summer, the amount of light or the change in the amount of light is much more gradual. So that you have the word solstice or solstitial, it means that the sun stands still. Sol is sun, and static or stitial, or stitial probably for Ela, she likes those kinds of pronunciations, it means standing still. For 3 days at the summer and winter solstices, the sun does not increase or decrease in declination. So we have the natural division of the Earth into three zones. The frigid zones, which you could say are like the father, and they are ruled by Saturn. You have the tropic, which is the moon, and in between, the temperate zones are ruled by the sun. Divine spirit for the frigid zones, human spirit for the tropics, and life spirit, the middle person for the places in between. Now, the principle of analogy works that since the solstitial points are when they are closer to the polar extremes, area around the solstice is is like the father or the divine spirit or the number one. And so the entire circle that we're talking about, so that if this is Aries is both relative to the equinox and relative to the solstice, Aries is a number three. Taurus is obviously a number two. Gemini, a number one. Cancer, a number one. Leo, a number two. And Virgo, a number three. Libra, a number three. Scorpio, a number four. number two. Sagittarius in number one, Capricorn in number one, and then coming back the other way again, Aquarius in number two, and Pisces in number three. So we can see that there is, what I'm trying to do with this is I'm trying to relate the zodiac to the declinational cycle, because the two are radically interactive with each other, such that most of astrology that we have about the zodiac, quite a bit of that is actually not about the longitudinal movement of the sun through the different signs of the zodiac. It is much more having to do with the change of the sun in terms of declination. It is not where we are in the orbital revolution that makes for the seasons. It is the declinational changes that make for the changes in the seasons. Because with the declinational change, the incidence of light that comes from the sun changes. And all astrological influence is based on the angles of incidence. So that it's a very important thing. Now, each of these little boxes that we have broken the cycle into, each of those little boxes has a certain declination. And things that share either relative to the solstice or the equinox that share a similar declination are parallel to each other. And the parallel is just about, if not certainly, the strongest aspect in astrology. But its effect is physical. It is not so much psychological. When you are working with parallels in a horoscope, you are working with attitudes that have worked their way so far into the physical personality that they deal with physical conditions and illnesses and things like that. The orb of a parallel is 1.5 degrees, which means that each degree, each planet with its orb is influential over a 3-degree difference in declination. And 3 degrees difference in declination is very close, not exactly, but it is like 1/7 of going toward the north or the south of, if we break the north declination into 7 parts, 23 degrees divided by 7, it comes out to be right around 3 degrees. So let's try to understand that a little better, and let's do that by going back to telling stories and back to mythology. Now, this time we'll go to a different mythology. We'll go to that of Northern Europe. The best that we have left from that is associated with Norse mythology, though it's in the same shared with Germanic mythology. In Northern European mythology, chaos was called Gnungagap. And in chaos, or in Gnungagap, cosmos was brought about. And it was brought about when space and time were polarized to north and south. Now, in the north, it was called the land or the area or that direction was called Niflheim, which literally means the land of ice. And the southern extreme was called Muspelheim, which means the land of fire. And between the two of them, there developed a tremendous mist, and that humanity and civilization developed under the myth. Now, the pole of the Earth, the middle part of it, which was called the Midgard, the pole of that was seen as a tree. And just like the tree on my family farm, at the top there was a hawk that sat. And what we're talking about here is a cosmography, I guess is what you would call it. The inner earth itself, inside of it, was filled with serpents. Whereas surrounding the earth, what was called the Midgard serpent. And the Midgard serpent represented the element water, just as hell represented the element of fire, and Fenris the wolf represented the element of air. Now the name of this tree, which is impossible to spell and pronounce, is called Yggdrasil, Yggdrasil. And Yggdrasil was a tree that was so tall that if you stood at its base, you couldn't see the top of it. But it was beside having the hawk on it, it was a home to many different things. All kinds of birds lived in there. And on the branches of the tree, tree branches, there were goats that ate the tree branches. And the at the roots, and the roots each go into a different dimension. And see, it's a pretty sophisticated myth. At the roots, the serpents, just like the Scorpio beings always are, they were gnawing at the roots, and they were always trying to bring the world down, or the world tree down. Now, way up high in the tree was the throne of Odin. And Odin ruled, you know, like heaven, in the direction of heaven, was called Asgard, whereas Middle Earth was called Midgard. And I don't know what more to say, but at any rate, the Odin sat up there. He had one eye fewer than some people, because at the base, where one of the roots entered the earth or entered a dimension, there was a pool. And at that pool, there were three Norns or Fates who were called the Urd sisters. And they were the Norns. And they were the Fates in Northern mythology. Their names were Ud, Skuld, and Verdande. And at their pool, if you looked into the pool, you could see the future. And like all people who are involved with politics, Odin was concerned about his future, and he wanted to look in the pond to see whether his rulership was going to be secure. And they told him only if he sacrificed one of his eyes. And for this reason, Odin is pictured with a patch on one of his eyes, but they got it all wrong. The eye that he sacrificed was the third one, because you cannot enter into the clairvoyance of knowing about things and do that for personal ends, and you have to sacrifice that for the good of all. All right, so now we see that, and the branches on, oh, there was a squirrel that was like spinal impulses. The squirrel ran up and down the tree, communicating between the Norns and Odin. Would warn him if there were things that he needed to do. Now, this tree can be associated within the Bible with Jacob's ladder. And in Greek mythology, it can be associated with the ladder of the stars, which was the ladder of liberation that led away from the earth and into the Milky Way, which was a much higher order of creation. Now, the ladder of the stars is what is sometimes called the Ptolemaic or the Chaldean order of the planets. And the way it is set up is that the closer a planet is to the Earth, the faster it moves. And that determines the speed. The daily motion of a planet as seen from Earth determines its position on the ladder of the stars. So the first was the moon, which is the fastest moving. Then was Mercury, and then was Venus, and then was the Sun, and then was Mars, and then Jupiter, and then Saturn. This sequence of planets is, wow, it's behind almost everything. I've gone into it in all kinds of different talks. Now, when we look at this and tie this together with what we're talking about, the natural divisions of the earth, it is a really a beautiful thing, and it's quite profound. If we look back at the, let's put the planets right on the Earth. Let's move the tree right down to the Earth. Then we have the Moon here. We have Mercury here. Venus here. Sun. Mars. Jupiter. And up at the pole, we have Saturn. So we have Jupiter and Saturn in the... this is giving them each equal amount of space. This is taking the 90 degrees and dividing it by 7, which gives you 17 degrees, 13 degrees, 12.857 degrees. So Jupiter and Saturn are the polar, the tropical are the Moon and Mercury, and Mars, Venus, and the Sun represent the larger part of the thing, the temperate zones. If you want, you can add the pole of the, this is the magnetic field of the Earth, would be ruled by Uranus in its electronic way, and the colors that play through it are Neptunian, and the far out influences that come from the stars are ruled by Pluto. So the whole ladder of the stars can be put right on the Earth, and it becomes quite a significant thing. Now, if we look at this, you can do the same thing passing north, or you can do the same thing passing south. However, this was called not only a ladder, this was called Bifrost. It was called the Rainbow Bridge, and it's quite beautiful. Now, Dante, in his Divine Comedy, has the hell regions and the purgatorial regions in the whole lower hemisphere. It is that more per nation, there have been more fascist regimes in the southern hemisphere, and there has been more removal from evolution. Just Australia alone has all of those things, the missing links, like the platypi, which is a link between the mammals and the reptilian state. There have never been in the southern hemisphere the development of a new language, and there's never been naturally found, except by moving them there, there's never been roses found in the southern hemisphere. These are all just quaint curiosities. They may be meaningful, they may not. Remember last time we talked about Goethe's theory of light, when we looked at the structure of the zodiac. We said that color was a consequence of the interplay between light and darkness. And this is the whole spectrum was suspended between light and darkness. Now we find the same sort of thing in planetary qualities above or on the Earth, in between all silence and all sound. Might say that the notes of the scale are in between that. But at any rate, if you look at plants and fruits of plants, and that's not to say that all of the purple and blue plants are found in the north, but relative to the species that do fruit, more of the darker color fruit is found toward the Saturn end, like the ultraviolet and blue end, whereas more of the yellow and orange fruit, percentage-wise, are found toward the equatorial end of it all. So, to me, this has been utterly fascinating. I didn't think of all this when I was a kid, but over the years, I keep understanding more and more about it. Now, if we take this whole analogy, you know, I have a friend that used to have his office in the Wisconsin climatologist's office, and when I showed him this, he says, roughly speaking, the different things like the savannas and the desert regions and things like that of the different climates of the Earth follow the ladder of the stars. After I pointed it out to him, he says, yes, that works out perfectly fine. Now, what we want to take is the ladder of the stars and take it off of the hemisphere, and we want to shrink it down and put it in the ecliptic, or in the tropical region. And that is what we get here. In that fact, literally, that's what the color chart is. It is a banded, in fact, the banding here is much finer. It's banded to 1.5 degrees rather than 3. It is a banded division of the tropics, so that this is the area where all of the planets pass over. Now, what this says, and I've never been able to check this out completely because it takes an enormous amount of observation and sensitivity, but this says that every 3 degrees is ruled by a different planet, and that any other planet that is in that 3-degree area would have the quality of the background planet that ruled that stripe that went across. I've never been able to test it out, but analogously, it holds true. I don't know what to say. Yes, it's all utterly fascinating. I guess what I'm trying to do here again is I'm trying to recommend research, because understanding each of these bands and understanding each planet at each level of declination is something that has never been studied. The following the sun at each degree of declination, which is overwhelming in its influence on our life, has been done. It's done all the time. It's done by a science that is called chronology or chronography. And it's a science that anyone that can participate in, that I'm sure you can find it on the web. I haven't really looked. I should have checked that out. But you can become a chronographer. Anyone can. Like the first incident of a crocus coming out, if you write the day down, and then you send that in over year after year, just regular people like you and I, not great scientists, add on to chronographical things so that we understand, you know, what happens at each degree. The rising and falling of the sap is dependent more on the declination than it is on temperature. Temperature is a factor. You can go out there with a torch and you can heat up a tree and it will happen more, its sap will rise more quickly. But it is the incidence of the angle of light that does more to bring the sap up than the heat. So I don't want to too much assume a character for all of these things, but I just think it would be a nice idea if somebody got interested in Mark Lex going out into nature, and maybe he can do things if he knew what plants were ruled by what things, and how the ruler of those plants, when it's in such and such a band, has such and such the plants thrive better, or something like that. I have all sorts of things lined up for your time, don't I? All right. Now, when we're working with the declinational cycle of the sun, we're working with something that's a little bit more difficult than working with the longitudinal cycle. That is because there's overlap. There are things that are related to the signs as well as to declination, and to separate them out is not something that has been done. Familiarity. Most astrologers do not deal with declination, and they do not deal with parallels. And very little has been done with it. And you're dealing with a lot of subtlety. The solar cycle is quite obvious, but the other cycles in terms of declination and the various declinational bands, that's very subtle. and you're way out on a limb or you're way out on thin ice if you're trying to do that. And then there's confusion. You're likely to confusion because of other things might be the factors. This is something that Mark and I have talked about in the past. There are declinational stars. And a declinational star is a star that is at a given declination. Sometimes it stays at that declination in the precessional cycle for quite a long time. And that means that every day a declinational star will pass over every planet that is at that geographical latitude. And so if it happens to be a strong, influential star, that is going to look really good on camera. That star will have a very strong influence on everything that is directly under it. It's just inverse. Everything. No, that has to do with the obliquity of the orbit, that it spends more time in the northern hemisphere. Not much, but a little bit. All right. So a latitude star can have a really strong influence. And that brings us to something that is quite interesting. This is something that was studied quite a bit. It was studied by ancient people, but we don't have records of it. And that is, they did study latitude stars. People followed the stars, especially the bright ones that passed right directly over the city. And what the situation is, people used to think, and to some extent it is true, but I don't know how strong the phenomenon is, that if you are deep down in a well, or if you are deep down in the passage of a great pyramid or something like that, and you look out, because there is not so much side light interfering with your vision, you can see very bright stars in the daytime. It's not a real standout like you see us go out at night like this and see it that's real strong. It still is debatable how strong the influence is, and I think it probably depends on the sensitivity of a person's sight. Now, what the people used to do, this was such an important thing, that they built towers that were called star towers. And those star towers were very carefully made to be at exactly right angles to the earth or to level with the earth. They were completely closed. They had no doors, they had no side windows, and there was only one opening. I don't know how they accomplished it, but that one opening was in the center of the tower at the top. And the arrangement from getting from the top down to the bottom was a spiral staircase or a spiral ladder or something like that around the outside of the building. And the spiral always had to go one way so that you were turning to the right when you were rising and turning to the left when you were going down. And then if you were on a cot or laying on your back on the ground, you could tell when a bright star would be exactly overhead, because people felt that this meant something very important, and this was some kind of optimal time for the people that lived in that city. Now, it's a funny thing, but this description of a star tower is exactly the description of the tower in which Danae was exiled by her father, because her father was told that if he had a grandchild by his daughter Danae, he got this from the oracle, that grandchild would kill him. So he locked her in a tower that's exactly described like the star tower. And through the top of the star tower, Coming as a cloud of golden light, Zeus came into the tower because Danae was very beautiful and united with her. And the progeny of that interaction was the great hero Perseus. In fact, Perseus, who is after whom he was supposedly the progenitor of the line of royalty in Persia, which is called Perseus for Persia. And but at any rate, probably what they're trying to say is that this kind of tower was used for initiation in some sort of way. And so that when certain light was available to a person, they were ready to be initiated. Now, interestingly enough, one of the most famous towers in the world is supposedly some kind of star tower. And that is the famous Leaning Tower at Pisa was a star tower. I don't know if it was completely closed on all the sides or not. Have you ever been to Italy? You'll have to go on a field trip for us and tell us that it's so or not so. I had so good having you back in the class again. All right. Now let's do a very quick look, superficial look, at the solar declinational cycle. And when we talk about this, we're talking about it from the northern hemisphere. In the southern hemisphere, it's the same thing pretty much in reverse. All right. The cycle, as we understand it, is about the sun. And the sun is all about energy and vitality. And from the time of winter solstice to back to summer solstice, that part of the cycle, from winter solstice going forward to summer solstice, is a time where the life forces and the solar forces are externalizing in the northern hemisphere. So that period is, I forget the name. It has to do with the obliquity of the ecliptic. And those are either signs, I believe those are signs of long ascension. Yes. Whereas from the summer solstice back to the winter solstice are times of internalization, and those signs are signs of short ascension, which means to say that they stay on the ascendant for a shorter amount of time. So what we're talking about here is there are many factors in astrology that are all interactive with each other. Obviously, the time from the vernal equinox to the autumnal equinox is all outward. The first half of it is outward and externalizing, and the second half of it is outward and internalizing. So just using those two keywords, internalization and externalization, and outside of the surface and inside of the surface, has several pieces of chalk. That right from that alone, you have a good understanding or a pretty good understanding of how the declinational cycle works and what it means. By looking at the bands when it's external and externalizing and internal and internalizing, you get to more and more of a state of refinement. This cycle, obviously, has its effect most strongly on all living things. And so that, especially plant life. If you want to understand the nature of the cycle, you know, like get a Culpepper's herbal and look at what plants are ruled by what planets and how they fare when the declination is thus and so. You know, some plants come on late in the year, some come on early in the year, and things like that. Now, all of this is something that needs to be done. not a whole lot has been done. The principle behind angularity of this kind is a principle that is behind the deepest things in creation. If we understand from observing the year and the things that happen at the different cycles of the year, we understand how part of the great creation itself is accomplished. In the great creation, the points in the infinite points of cosmic root substance, the points that are chosen for creative manifestation, are set at different angles. And then emanating to those angles is an irradiation, an internal irradiation from the divine spirit, or depending on what level you are working on, and depending on the inclination, you have this wave. So the whole idea of light theory, of theory of color, the whole idea of sound, and in the beginning of was the word, and the whole inclination of the axes themselves being suspended between light and darkness, this is a very, very big principle. If you solve this, and you solve it in a living way so that you can attune yourself to each of the colors, or you can attune yourself to any sphere or any realm or any spiritual world, and you can be clairvoyant and you can operate in that sphere. So what we're talking about is an extremely fundamental thing. All right. Yeah, we all, this has, same things happened last time. We got way away from everyday astrology, and we find the roots of the universe and how everything in the cosmos functions. Yes. People tune into what are called by some people levels of consciousness. Other people call them planes, other people call them realms, and other people call them worlds. And they form a scale or of color or of tone, and that is dependent on, this is abstractly speaking now, that is dependent on positions in space relative to the transmission, the geometric transmission of sound or light or intelligence, and that is what produces, is what some people would call vibratory level, because you know, the spinning and the emanation toward them produces this kind of wave. This kind of wave is actually an expression of the word, and so it isn't quite as simple as we picture with our three-dimensional materialistic consciousness. We have to learn to take the ideas that we get from physics and drop the physical way we got to them, and then we can get the ideas in spirit, and then we can literally attune ourselves to that reality. All right. Next time we'll be much closer to real astrology. Is yes. Yep. Yes. Yes. What is called astral cartography is only one factor. That's one factor, and it's one factor that is given too much attention. And there are some people that do much better in one of those bands than they do in another band, because they are those kinds of people. I happen to be a desert person, but my social and, how would you say it, my destiny with people has me in Wisconsin. I like being in Wisconsin, but my personality thrives in the desert. And a southern desert at that. Okay. Let's do a little bit of stating of some principles of what we're doing here. All heavenly bodies influence the Earth astrologically. And they all have compound declinational cycles with regard to the Earth. Some planets, like Venus and Mercury, the internal planets, have cycles relative to the Earth, but they're biased by being near the Sun all the time, so their declinational cycles are biased. You know, they're solar influenced. Some planets, like Jupiter, stay very close to the heart of the ecliptic. It only, I think, only gets 3 degrees off of the dead center of it. All planets, or all heavenly bodies, but let's leave it to planets, have pairs of nodes that correspond to the equinoxes. And they all have highs and lows. The equinoctial-like nodes are critical in indicating states of change. Just as being external versus being internal is a very big state of change. All cycles of this type have analogous activities in turning or outgoing, external or internal, materially active or spiritually active. They have the same analogous, but each planet does its own work. When Jupiter is in its northern hemisphere, it's obviously, it may be more building, but it's more building in the work that is Jupiterian than it is building in the work that is solar. So we're talking about all kinds of cycles here that are almost untouched astrologically. I think even most of the programs, this is where you can get on people like Windstar and say, please include an ephemeris of planetary nodes. If you write to them or if you have correspondence with them, and if enough of us do that, because it's a really trivial thing, so to include planetary nodes in a horoscope, we'll come up a little bit, but they are things that there is research for them, that there are effects. The nodes themselves can be seen as active points. Best example are lunar nodes. In India, there is a whole part of astrology that's based on the north and south nodes of the moon. And the moon, because it is inclined to the ecliptic by 5 degrees, has quite very, it doesn't have a curve like this. It has a curve that has another curve built on top of it, so that sometimes it is called the moon is riding high or the moon is riding low, and so the declination of the moon changes quite a bit. But the lunar astrology, the cycle based on lunar declinations, and the whole cycle of the nodes of the moons is one of the things that is found in all kinds of cycles. It's a 19-year cycle. And if you look at different cycles, research that have done the vast number of cycles of things that go up and come down, you know, like foxes and rabbits go up at the same time, go down at the same time. That's kind of logical. There's going to be a lot of rabbits and there's going to be a lot of foxes. And they go in the same cycle as the moon's nodes. They go in 19-year cycles. There are stellar cycles that are much more precessional, and that have to do with things like latitude stars. And then there are planetary cycles. But the planetary cycles require some adjustment, because the nodes of the planetary cycles are heliocentric. And in order to find when something is in north hemisphere or south hemisphere of the solar system, you have to get heliocentric coordinates, and then you have to change them to celestial longitude and latitude and things like that. And then you have to see where they actually appear on the ecliptic. The nodes themselves have effects, and I don't know of any studies that have been done on the various planets, especially strong planets like Jupiter and Saturn, when they're in their northern hemisphere or in their southern hemisphere. That's something Mark can look into also. In heliocentric astrology, or just in the celestial mechanics of the solar system, the nodes for most of the planets are constant. And the really easy to calculate if you want to sit down and make a program for your calculator or in your computer, you can do that. The only one that is not constant is Mercury, because Mercury is the only planet known to have a revolution of the apsides. I have to leave, huh? Good night. Thanks for coming. So, what I'm suggesting, rather than going out for a few beers, it might be a very good idea to start doing some research as far as the planetary cycles in the northern and southern hemisphere. There has not been much research in that, but one of the best astrologers of the 20th century did research on the nodes of Venus and especially Mercury. And she found that especially aspects of Mercury as seen from the Earth relative to the nodes of Mercury have to do with children who have problems with mental development and things like that. And she has very good data on that. I tried to get her ephemeris for the nodes for distribution to you, but she didn't want to release it because the book is still in print and there's some possibility that she didn't make some money on it. I don't know if she's alive anymore. But, all right, you have the idea of what we're talking about. We're saying that if we want to know what the times are like, we have to be like farmers. We have to know that it's harvest time now, and it's not the time that we plant unless it's garlic, and we're planting for next year or into a week or something like that. And we're saying that the declinational cycle of the sun in determining the times is quite important. We went into all kinds of other things for the fun of it. Next time what we'll do is we'll go into another kind of cycle that is much more astrological and much more exciting and relates much more to our lives if we are not farm people. Are there any questions?
First of all, does the Python
roughly speaking, yes, they had a similar thing where the prophecy used to be done by Erda first. They don't talk about it being turned over to Python, but it is turned over to one of the gods later on. I forget which one it is. Are you talking down here? Yes. These are bands that are half size, and they start from the equator, so that the first one north of the equator and south of the equator is the moon, then Mercury, then Venus and Sun. This is not that accurately done. It's just to make bands that are different.
The color should be straight to the planet as it's going up and it's going to get into it as it's coming down passing through it.
I don't know what you mean.
For example, when we come to the time of Aries
red.
Okay, so it would start out as
Actually, this is going this way in time.
Yes.
This is T0 going this way. This is going from Aries to Taurus to Gemini.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't made the legend yet. I'm working on it now. Yes, there are extremes. The width of the Python is to allow for something to be in a planet and in a declination. There are various combinations of declinations and longitudes to get the optimal of them is what determines the width of the Python. And as far as the declinational view of the cosmos versus the longitudinal, they don't fit perfectly. It can't be done, actually, because they're two totally different outlooks on the universe. All right, you got another question? Okay. I'm going to do that next year. I'm going to do a course that's completely on the aspect, and there will be three or four lectures on the parallel alone. It's going to be probably a three-year course. It is something that has to do with built-in physical conditions. Something that you may have forgotten the habit or the attitude that produced the physical condition, but it relates to the planet that was behind that attitude, even though the attitude may not no longer exist. So the parallel is almost exclusively doing the physical conditions. If there is a complementary or a corresponding attitude from the science of the zodiac, then it's very clear what the parallel means and what it's working on, what subject. Oh. Well, there are four different kinds of parallels that you can have. But basically, on this chart, any planets that are in the same band, no matter what part of the zodiac they are in, they are parallel. So that if something is here in the early degrees of Aries and something is here in Virgo, and they're both in that yellow strip, they are parallel to each other. A planet is parallel with another planet when it is in the same degree of declination, north or south. So that if a planet is in this first yellow band north, second yellow band north, and one is in the second yellow band south, such as over here in Libra, they would be parallel. Well, they call it contraparallel. There are all kinds of definitions of parallel that I don't want to use just contraparallel. Yes. Declination. The ecliptic is the sun's path. No, to the celestial equator of the Earth. It's completely local to the Earth. Yeah. I don't like to use contraparallel because contraparallel means only if there is an opposition involved. And if there's an opposition involved, that's different than if one is north and one is south and there is not an opposition. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some with very few. I don't know the numbers of what would be the maximum and what would be the minimum. I do know that it's possible for the moon to be in a place where it's impossible for it to be parallel to any planet. That's one of those things with the moon rather high. It gets out of bounds. Okay. No, not necessarily. No. All depends on whether you have the Sun conjoined Saturn or not.